I'm Dan.
And I'm Jordan.
And this is the Money Basics Podcast.
All right. So we're back on our episode 10 of our podcast.
Is that how we're starting?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just go. We're into it now.
So we didn't really have a plan of what we wanted to talk about today. And sort of kind of coincidentally, things kept coming up.
To be clear, we have a lot of plans. It's just been a really busy couple of weeks.
Well, don't sugarcoat it. I had zero plan, but yeah, it's been busy. But yeah, for real, things have been coming up. I actually got approached by somebody at work talking about retirement actually came up in terms of planning / lack of planning, and that discussion came about. And I just had a little bit of a conversation with that person. And then coincidentally, when I sort of freelance talked about it with you, you had said that you were writing an article about that very subject.
Yeah, it's something I think about quite a bit, actually. So the idea being just retirement preparation for it. It's something that has crossed my mind a lot, and I'm actively planning for it, and I've got a lot of thoughts and opinions, and I'm sure you've sort of got your own plans, thoughts, and opinions as well. So it was kind of timely that something sort of in the psychosphere, whatever you want to call that.
Yeah. And then I brought it up, so I posted a few things on social media because I kind of took the reins the last couple of days because of how busy you were, and I posted things about a term called FIRE, which stands for, in this context, financially independent, retire early. And you can find Reddit groups on this. You can find all kinds of social media stuff.
It's like a common movement. There's a lot of people posting about it. Basically, the gist of it is get your money in order, and if you start young and do it aggressively, then you could retire young. And it's just sort of, and retirement can mean different things for different people, but generally it just means like not relying on your 9-to-5 for the rest of your life, basically until you're 70 years old and then retiring. It's taking control of your finances and retiring on your terms, even if retiring for you means like slowing down and just working part-time, doing something you like instead of, you know, the 9-to-5 grind for forever.
Yeah, so in today's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about some strategies to do that and what I'm doing. That's what I'm going to talk about. I don't know if you want to throw some stuff in there. Sure you will, because you have your own strategies as well. Obviously, we're in two different circumstances, as we've been saying in the podcast. And I also wanted to point out that there's been a few recurring themes in a lot of our episodes, and that will come about later on as we talk about it, and I'll bring it up back then as well. So let's break down this FIRE thing again, just to full circle this. What is it? So Dan broke it down, just basically saying that, and I've heard people describe, like, say, Freedom 55 or Freedom, whatever the age number is, I think would be in the same category, basically. And yeah, that's just it. It's basically, you know, living your best life in retirement, not having to worry about it. And the next question I have about that is, how can we do it? How can you do it as a listener? How can we do it as, you know, you and I sitting here right now? And there are various ways for people to be able to do it. And the reason I brought that question up as well is because I maybe haven't heard it in a while, but I have heard it before, and maybe I'll hear it if some people talk to me about this episode, is saying, well, that's never going to be me. I'm never going to be able to retire early. I'm going to work for the rest of my life. And I do see people that do that. They will retire, but then go back to work because they have to, because they only realize that more or less after they retire or a few years out from retirement that, oh, like, I'm not going to be able to sustain my lifestyle because of how expensive everything is, or what my income is going to be like, and all that kind of stuff. And I think what bothers me about that is the fact that someone's only thinking about retirement seemingly 2 years in, you know, out, or, you know, less than, you know, very short timeline out from retirement. Retirement should be something that, and as your article brought out this morning that I read around this subject too, you know, getting at it as early as possible. And obviously when we're young, we don't, you know, you're not an 18-year-old coming out of school, 19, 20 coming out of school thinking about retirement, really. Nobody really does, which is nice when we get into these things like company match pensions and all kind of stuff. We'll talk about it after. But starting early, how can we do it? That's the best way to do it, is getting into some sort of investments. There's a few vessels to be able to do that. Getting into some passive income stuff, and we'll break down that up down a little bit. So on the subject of pensions, okay, there are different types of pensions. So just that, Dan and I as an example, Dan's in into a pension called OMERS through the fire department. I'm in a pension called HOOP through the hospital. Those are two of the ones that I know of that are bigger. There's also, I've heard of company matched RRSPs. Mm-hmm. So basically a company will get into an RRSP, like a group RRSP. Do you know a lot about, I don't know much about that.
Like in a nutshell, I do like the inner workings. I've never been involved in that personally, but basically in a nutshell, the way it works is it's an RRSP that like is, works very similarly to any other RRSP that you would open, but your employer will actually contribute to it on your behalf. And in some of these, in a lot of these cases, maybe all of them, I'm not certain, but this can be a voluntary enrollment as well. So what happens is you're like, you would sign up for this and register for this plan where you would choose to have, let's say, $500 taken off every paycheck, for example. That number can differ depending on what you got going on. But let's say $500 comes off every paycheck and your employer will match either that full amount or some percent of that amount. So you contribute $500, they contribute $500 into your RRSP on your behalf. And there are some private companies. So like, you know, we work public sector, like we're various levels of government employees. But there are some private companies that will actually do that, and they'll do like stock-based compensation for that. So it might be a company matched RRSP, and they'll actually issue shares or like buy shares of that company for you. Which is cool. That's a pretty sweet deal.
My buddy who works for CN gets that. He gets like a stock option retirement thing.
Yeah, that's a cool deal. But these people also, in my opinion, should kind of take this whole like risk management thing upon themselves, because you've heard of some people, I'm sure, in like big companies, like Shopify is one that does that. I'm sure back in the day, like Nortel probably did that. And I see this online all the time. People have all this stock in the company they work for. Think about how dangerous that is. Your entire salary, your entire income, your entire, like all the money that you get comes from this employer, this one company. And then your retirement plan is stock in this one company. What happens if something happens to that company? You're screwed. You lose everything. Mm-hmm. So it's cool. Like these plans, it's a pretty good benefit sometimes. They'll actually, like, I would love, if I work for a very successful company, to have like share-based compensation of some sort, whether that's retirement or just like performance bonus. But I would definitely be investing my own money outside of that on like various other companies just to offset my risk. Just something to consider if you're in that position. But yeah, that's in a nutshell how these like employer-matched RRSPs work.
I have a few questions around that too. So the employee-matched RRSPs, the ones that my wife's been involved in was a percentage of her income, kind of like how our pensions work. So she didn't really, I mean, I'm sure you can play with the numbers a little bit, but basically it kind of went automatically. My question is does that affect any of your like RRSP contribution room?
Absolutely. And in fact, your pension right now and my pension right now, like these provincial pensions, that does affect your RRSP room. And you can find all that information on the CRA. There's like a whole pension adjustment line. And that like, so Sabrina, my fiance, she's self-employed. She gets more room in her RRSP than I do because of the pension adjustment line. So the government actually factors that in.
So me being in HOOP, mm-hmm. in a retirement plan, I would have to basically run the numbers to figure out, once I start my own personal RRSP as an investment vessel, I wouldn't be allowed the maximum contribution.
No, but the thing is, like, that room piles up. So like you got nothing to worry about for the foreseeable future, because you've probably got like 60, 70 grand of room there. I'm not sure what that number is, but it would be a huge, like, you're not going to fill that this year.
No.
But yeah, as you start contributing money, like, I don't know, let's say you get 20 grand in there, like you probably still have a ton of room left, but it might be worth starting to see like, okay, how much more room do I have? Because you've been paying in your pension for a little while, and every year that would reduce the amount that you would accumulate in that account. So eventually you'll catch up. And you just don't want to over-contribute. You'll just be hit with some tax, that's all.
Interesting. Yeah. Something to look into.
But the CRA has that. You just go on the MyCRA website. It's a pain in the ass to register for, because they want like very specific details about your tax returns to like authenticate you. But that's all just like in black and white right on the CRA website. You can see exactly what your space is. They're a little slow to update, but it's all there.
Cool. So that's kind of like, I like the scenario that I'm in. I'm sure you do as well, because HOOP is really good. My pension plan, every dollar I put in, I think it's $1.25, or it might be a little bit more now. But then if you get your statements, like I get my monthly or quarterly statements or whatever they are, and it tells me how much I'll get when I retire at X age or X age, and they kind of break it down. If you look at those numbers now, obviously I'm not retiring for another, you know, 20 plus years. Those numbers will be different. And a good example of that was this year, HOOP announced they were going to increase the retirement fund, basically saying they're just going to give you X amount percentage more when you retire. And I'm sure they're going to adjust as it goes on. Obviously, you know, $3,000 today is going to be much different 20 years from now. So there's that. But even at that, with those adjustments, I feel like if I were to live my current lifestyle, that would not be enough to sustain what I'm doing. So that's where it brings me to the point of, well, that's not the only thing that we as Canadians get in retirement. And your article touched on this a little bit, and maybe you can speak a little bit about that. So I'm talking about the CPP and the old age security and all that stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of different scenarios out there from our listeners that are like tuning into this, and you and I, even our scenarios differ, but it's important to know that if you're a Canadian citizen and you've been employed in Canada, I can't think of any scenario where you would not have contributed to CPP. That would have come off your paycheck, or even if you're self-employed, you have to contribute to this. And CPP is the Canadian Pension Plan. It's like the government-run pension plan for all citizens of Canada who are taxpaying and working citizens, right? So if you've contributed to this, then you're entitled to it when you retire. And then they basically, the amount of money you're going to get paid from CPP upon retirement, I mean, there's this sort of complicated formula to it, and it also is affected by how much money you earn or don't earn. So if you make a whole bunch of money, it claws back your CPP a little bit, but also like the amount that you contributed to it over your working lifetime is going to affect that. So there's all kinds of different dynamics that affect it. So the article that I wrote, I just did a little research and found like the average payment of like the average Canadian. So it's like the average across like 40 million people. So it's not like a super accurate number to base all your calculations off of, but I think that number was like $700 or $800 a month. You might make more, you might make less. There's a lot of things that will affect it. So that's one thing. And you're gonna get that whether or not you're like us, who has an actual pension plan from an employer, like we'll have our employer pension, but we're also gonna get CPP when we apply for it. And I say that because you can choose within a certain window when you apply for it. Like if I take my CPP when I'm like 60, I'll make less money than if I take my CPP at 65. So there's like some formulas and stuff that you can find online where people will tell you the most efficient time to take it. But essentially all these mathematical formulas come down to like, you have to sort of decide when you think you're going to die and then figure out like, will I get more money out of CPP if I start taking the cash earlier, even though it's a smaller monthly amount? Or would it be more beneficial to wait a little bit later and get the larger monthly amount? So anyways, so CPP, that's one source of income you're going to get. The next source of income you're going to get is OAS. That's your old age security. This one I'm a little less clear on. I did a little research for the article, but I got to tell you, my brain is mush. But essentially, this is like an old age bonus that you get at age 65, if I'm not mistaken. And I think you read the article. Do you remember how much that was on average? I want to say like close to somewhere around $600 or $700 a month, I think. It was similar to what CPP was. Don't quote me on that. But anyways, you get that at age 65. And as far as I can tell, you get that because you're old. It's interesting with at least with my pension, I don't know if it's the same for yours, but when I retire, I'll retire young-ish, like relatively young, and my pension will actually pay me an OAS bridge benefit. Have you ever heard that term before?
I have not.
So a bridge benefit. So if I look at the calculations, the breakdown of my pension, they're going to pay me a certain monthly amount. And for the first, like if I retire when I think I am, which will be like in my early 50s, I will make an increased amount of money from that pension, from this OAS bridge benefit up until age 65, and then my pension's going to stop paying me that bridge because OAS is going to kick in. So for a guy like me, I shouldn't see a whole lot of difference at age 65, but the source of that money is going to change a little bit. If you don't have a pension, that OAS kicking in at age 65 is actually going to be a pretty sweet bonus for you, and you'll get that as long as you're still alive, right?
I should look into that.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, that's not something that I log into often, like my HOOP pension plan. Like, I couldn't even tell you how much money I have in there. I just know, like, roughly how much they said that they're going to give me in retirement, which is around $3,000 a month, or maybe a little bit more now. But like I said, it's not something I actively look at, and I should, just to know. I mean, it'd be nice to know how much total money I have in the account right now.
Yeah, because, I mean, theoretically, you could cash that out anytime you wanted to.
I've had friends that have done that.
Yeah, and it's like it's a risky move. Like it would only make sense to do that if you had some crazy opportunity where you needed all this cash up front, and
what my friend did,
and you were very certain it was going to work out because it's a big risk.
It's work out for him
because, like you said, your employer pitches in a whole bunch on your behalf, and if you cash it out, you're going to miss out on this big benefit, like the whole purpose of the pension. So you basically end up with way less money. So the only reason it would make sense to cash out early is if you had a reasonable expectation that you were going to put that money to work to make up for what you're giving up in the future, right? So
yeah, and I at this point in the podcast or this episode, I'd like to say this is a teachable moment. The point of sort of the up until this point is that CPP and OA old age security is not going to be enough. Should probably won't be enough to sustain you in retirement.
No, it's not. And like on its own, no.
And you would be best in whatever situation you're in to get into a company matched retirement plan, but obviously there's many different options, so you want to look into it further for yourself because there could be a possibility that the company that's offering whatever pension might not suit your needs, or maybe it's not a good deal or whatever. So definitely do your own research, look into it, see if it fits your style. But if there is something like, as an example, Dan and I, him being in the Olmers pension plan, me being in the Hoop, that would be your best bet. And if you can start paying to that as soon as you start working, the sooner the better. It's a percentage that comes for Hoop anyway. It's a percentage that comes off your paycheck. You don't even notice it really. I started it, I think I was 22 or 23. I could have started it earlier and I probably should have, but I'm only missing about 4 or 5 years really if I think about it. But if you can like get a, you know, say you get some sort of healthcare related job, you can get into the Hoop pension plan, which is what they target most. Although they're probably expanding a lot of their companies that are trying to invest in it, because that's all they do, right? Hoop and Olmers, they're just a big investment firm, really.
That's it.
They take all the money from their members, which are people like you and I that pay into it, and they just invest the money.
Yeah.
And get a return and then pay us a payout whenever we retire. So that's just kind of how that works, but like very high level. Obviously there's a lot more to it. So planning early and getting involved in stuff early is the right move to do. Now I want to get into a little more specific scenarios, and one that came up to me which prompted me writing the talking points for this episode. And that's, if what if you didn't get into this early? What if you bounced around jobs quite a bit? You didn't get into one sort of specific retirement plan until later. You know, you've cut your retirement timeline in half. You only started, you know, paying into when you're 40 or something.
Yeah, and I see that, like, even on my job, we have a good pension and stuff, but we're forced to retire at age 60, which means that shortens your runway, right? And in a lot of pension plans, won't be universally true, but in a lot of pension plans, like, I used to always say, if I got into a job that had a pension plan and I started paying into it by 30, I knew I was going to be in great shape to retire. For many people, you could probably extend that out potentially, depending how your life, like your retirement life, is going to be. But you know, most people retire at 65 ish. So if you extend that out to 35, like, you could be in pretty good shape. So just understand that, like, if you're like 24 and you're like, oh my god, I don't have a pension, like, don't worry, you're okay. but something to consider right now. If you're like beyond that threshold and like you don't have a pension plan set up, you don't have much of a retirement fund set up, you're not completely screwed. Like, there's actions you can take to set you up on the right path, right? But there's a lot of moving pieces that you have to think about it. And I don't find a lot of people think about retirement either enough, or like they don't even understand what retirement is going to look like. And you need to have a clear picture of this to have a good plan to like be ready financially for retirement. So the first thing that you need to consider is, like, everyone's always like, well, how much money am I going to make in retirement? But the amount of money you make in retirement is kind of irrelevant let me back up. Do you need $5,000 a month, for example, in retirement if you don't have any debt and you don't have any payments? No, you don't need $5,000. It's a shitload of money if you don't spend much money. You know what I mean? Like, the only reason you might need $5,000 a month now, and this is just a wild example, the only reason you might need that much money now is because you've got your mortgage and you've got your car payment and you've got your student loans and your kids' college, whatever, right? But in retirement, if you plan very well and you don't have any of these things, you might be able to get away with like $2,000 a month because you're not paying out that much.
Yeah, right? So let me back you up just a little bit. So what you're talking about is to basically pre-plan a little bit to set yourself up for success in retirement.
Exactly.
And that means trying to get that, prioritizing getting the mortgage paid off before you retire.
Sure.
That way you're not paying this huge bill in your house. strategies that could be possible around that is, and a lot of people will do that, is they'll sell their house and downsize. Yeah. They'll get a smaller house depending on how the market is, stuff like that. Even I've even seen people go to back to renting, you know, stuff, or get into a condo or whatever, you know, whatever the strategy is. So, but the point is like sort of get rid of those big payments, right?
Yeah.
Don't have those car payments. Don't have those, that big mortgage, all that kind of stuff. So that's that's what you're touching on there now.
Reduce spending and you won't need as much money in retirement. Okay, so that's a very simple concept. And, you know, for some people that might mean selling your house and going to something smaller or moving to a cheaper city or whatever. But if you start early enough, or if, like, even if you're a little bit later in your career and you have a decent income, like, prioritize clearing that debt so that you're on track so that by retirement you don't have debt, right? So that's an option. The other thing too is there's things you can do to increase your income once you retire. And there's some simple things that you can do to do that. So we talked about CPP and OAS, right? And I said, you know, between the two, you're probably, the average person's probably looking at somewhere in the ballpark of $1,500 per month is what you're going to get from CPP and OAS. Like I said, circumstantial, that might not be an accurate number, but just rough ballpark, okay? Think about this. If you're a married couple or a common law or whatever, if you're a couple, times that by two. So your household income will be in the ballpark of $3,000. And that's just your government funded retirement money. Okay, so now you're up to $3,000. If you have any sort of pension, even if it's not a full 30 years of pension, maybe it's 15 years of pension, maybe it's 10 years of pension, whatever that amount is gonna be, add that to your $3,000 household income. And if you've got a partner, add their portion of pension, if they have it, to that income as well. And you can see how your household income starts to increase. Now, even where we're at now, like $3,000 plus, you know, maybe not that big of a pension, depending on your situation, might not sound like a lot, but if you combine that with a reduction in debt load, so you don't have a mortgage, you don't have a car payment.
No more payments.
Exactly. If you plan properly, so you don't have all this debt upon retirement, once again, you don't need that much money. So between the two of you splitting expenses, okay, now you're not making that much money. And that's actually a silver lining there, that you're not making that much money. You don't need that much money, but also you're paying less tax, right? And that's a huge strategy that people, like, that's kind of the whole purpose of the RRSP, is that you save money for retirement in this account so that when you retire, you're making less money, so you get taxed at a lower tax bracket. If you don't understand tax brackets, I got a free course on that.
We're going to plug that in, and we're going to link your latest article too, because it goes into all of this.
Yeah. So there's, that's another aspect people don't think about. Like, you're not making as much money, but you get to keep more of the money that you do make because you're in a lower tax bracket, assuming that you're not making boatloads of cash in retirement, which is usually true for most people. Most people make less in retirement. Now you can increase your income as well. And there's some simple ways to do that. So we talked about CPP, we talked about OAS, we talked about company pension plans, but also you can save your own money right now today to be ready for retirement. So I just mentioned the RRSP, that's a great tool. It's kind of a complicated tool. I've got articles on that as well.
And we talk about it in one of our episodes too. I can't remember which number
it is. It's in there somewhere. So further research on RRSP would be necessary, because, like, we could spend 5 hours talking about it. It's quite complicated, but it's an incredible tool. But another account that we have is the tax-free savings account, the TFSA. And the TFSA, it's a very simple tool. I mean, there's some rules to it, but it's very simple. You invest money in your tax-free savings account, and that grows over time. And when you later withdraw money from that account, you do not pay tax on it as long as you play by the rules. So think about it. You don't need to have a $1 million tax-free savings account. So imagine you got OAS, you got CPP, you're making your $1,500 a month, your spouse is also making $1,500 a month. You might have a little bit of pension, you might have a little bit of RRSP, and now what if you made an extra $200 or $300 a month in what you have in your tax-free savings account? Like, all these little bits add up. And then you keep in mind, the tax-free savings account, that's tax-free money. It also does not affect your tax bracket. So that's another thing. It keeps your tax, your income low, which keeps your tax bill low. So all these little pieces come into play in order to give you a better retirement, basically. So all stuff to consider.
Cool. So I want to get into a couple other strategies, and then I'm going to throw out my plan at the end. And sure. Then if you want to talk about yours, you can as well. So other income strategies, because we talk a little bit about passive income, and, like, as an example, into it in a tax-free savings account, perhaps. And that could look like, you know, owning REITs, which is basket of companies that pay dividends in form of, you know, rent or whatever.
No,
Sorry.
You're kind of crossing REITs and ETFs.
Yeah. Basically, you pay... All right, I'll simplify it. If you pay buy companies in your tax-free savings account that pay you a dividend, whatever company that is, then that can be considered... That's income that's tax-free. And that would be considered passive income because you're not really doing anything. You've put your money into a company, the company's paying you, and it's just all sitting there doing its thing. The other way that you can do passive income, but I want to argue that it might not necessarily be passive, is getting into rental properties. Mm-hmm. There are some people that I know that have done that in their retirement. They've had one, two, three, whatever amount of rental properties. They're collecting that rent. Some of them have kept that going in retirement. And some people will sell off some of those properties to fund their retirement. Now, there's two caveats to that I can think of off the top of my head. One, rental properties, in my opinion, is not 100% passive. There is a lot of work involved in dealing and managing rental properties, unless you go out and hire a company or somebody to deal with it and you're just collecting the money, but that's an expense. And number two caveat is when you end up selling properties, you are going to get taxed capital gain, and it can be quite a hefty sum.
Yeah. But if that's your wheelhouse, like, there can be big opportunity in the rental market as well. So if, like, that's something you're comfortable with and you know a lot about it, you know, that's a business you're comfortable being in, that might be a super viable strategy. A lot of people do it. I honestly, like, I keep an eye on the real estate market. I've got a pile of I'm not like Scarface here, but I have some money on the side waiting for an opportunity in the stock market. But also, if the real estate market crashed completely, I would seriously consider getting into the rental market if it made sense. I do think there's opportunity there, but I also think, at least where I live, it's an incredibly tight market, and I just don't see like the clear path to profitability. So for me, not really worth it, but I have heard of a ton of success stories. I think some timing is kind of important there too, like not buying the height of the market, but for sure that can work out. Absolutely.
Nice. I do want to touch back on RRSPs a little bit. So an RRSP can be a great tool, an investment vessel, but also obviously something to use in for retirement planning. But a question that came up recently to me that I didn't really have a fulsome answer to was, and you and I are in this situation, we are going to be getting a good pension when we retire. Would an RRSP be beneficial for someone like us who is going to get a pretty good sum of money in our retirement, which then our income in retirement would be, let's say for argument's sake, the same as we are now, which not necessarily, but just
for the simplicity. So to unpack this just really quickly, the RRSP, so this is an account you invest in over your lifetime, hopefully the longer the better. And then the money that you contribute to that account is tax-free. So yes, you contribute after-tax dollars for most people, but then you get the tax portion of it refunded to you. And the idea is you really should put that money back in the RRSP so that the money can grow tax-free. When you retire and you stop working and you decide to use that RRSP money, then you pay tax on it. But the idea being, you know, let's say I'm a high earner right now. My average tax rate is like 35%, something like that. It's a lot of tax. But when I retire and I'm making not much money, then I might pay like 25% tax. And so therefore, the money that I've earned will be taxed much less. I get to keep a lot more of it. Okay, that's in a nutshell one of the big benefits of the RRSP. The problem with that thinking, like you say, if you've got a really good pension plan and you retire and you're still making a bunch of money in retirement, well, that benefit might kind of evaporate, right? Like, I might go from a 35% tax rate to like a 32% tax rate because I'm making very similar income because of that pension being so good, still counts as income and still throws me into a tax bracket, right? So people sometimes ask me like, oh, should I invest in a TFSA? Should I invest in RRSP? And my answer to that is always yes. Like, invest in something, okay? Like, first and foremost, invest in one or the other. Like, just invest, okay? Now, if you really want to nitpick and find the most efficient thing, there's all kinds of these matrices that exist on, you know, if you're making this much money, it's more efficient to invest in this account and yada, yada, yada. I don't want to tell you what to invest in. This is more of a conversation you should have with a financial advisor because you need a complete picture of what your retirement is going to look like and all your sources of income. In my mind, the tax-free savings account is simpler. I'm not saying it's necessarily better. Okay, so for me personally, because I am going to have a good pension and I'm going to do quite well, like income wise in retirement, I don't expect a massive drop in my tax bracket, or at least I didn't. I hurried up to fill up my tax-free savings account. That was my priority because that won't affect my tax bracket. So my idea is fill that tax-free savings account and then I'll just let it grow and I'll just keep it topped up every year. And then when I retire, you know, I might pull in $1,000 or $1,500 a month from my tax-free savings account money, and that will not affect my tax rate. Now, things have changed in my life since I made that master plan. I'm engaged, plan to be married, and hopefully for the long run if she'll have me. But my fiance is self-employed. She does not have a pension. So her retirement is entirely self-funded. She'll get whatever she gets from the Canadian government, which we know isn't going to be enough on its own. She's also saving in her own RRSP. So what's going to happen when we retire on this current trajectory is that I'm going to make a lot of money because of my pension. And in retirement, she's not going to make a whole bunch of money. But what you can do as a couple is you can split that pension. I can give her half of my pension, which will drop my tax bracket dramatically. So instead of making, like, I'll be making probably the equivalent of about $80,000 a year in retirement. I mean, that's all hedged to inflation, but it'll be somewhere around that. So I can give her $40,000 of that to hugely drop my tax bracket. Now that RRSP money makes a lot of sense. It sucks for her because it's going to raise her tax bracket a little bit. But if you're looking at the total household taxable amount, it's going to drop our household taxable amount. And then we'll just figure it out internally. Like, our money will be our money combined. It won't be my money and her money. So we'll just have to figure out, like, you know, make it make sense so that she's not taking a huge hit. But in that case, the RRSP makes a lot of sense. Now, even if you are a high earner and think you will be a high earner in retirement, the RRSP can still make sense. Because remember what I told you, the money that you put in there. So like most of us, you get paid, your tax is automatically deducted, right? Well, if you put that cash into an RRSP, you're going to get a refund on the tax that you've already paid because you shouldn't have. That money that goes in the RRSP, in theory, should be tax-free. So the government's going to, at the end of the year, at income tax time, they're going to pay you back the tax. And if you're smart, you'll put that tax refund back into the RRSP. And if you do that, even as a high-income person in retirement, like you'll be at a high tax bracket, well, if you do that for like 10, 20, 30 years, that's 10, 20, 30 years of that money growing, that pre-tax money growing in the account. So, okay, you're gonna take a huge tax hit, but it's gonna be a massive amount because you were contributing 30% more, whatever your tax rate was, 30 or 35% more to that investment account than you would have if you were investing in the tax-free savings account.
So what I'm hearing you say is basically the power of compounding by reinvesting the money you get back, even at a higher tax bracket, hitting that, taking that bigger tax hit is still worth it.
It could certainly be. Now, like I said, there's matrices that'll sort of dissect this. So don't be like, well, Dan said, like, do your research on this. There's a lot of things that's going to affect this. I'm just saying don't discount either of these options. Like,
and that's what I've run into. There's some people that I have approached me and saying, well, because I had mentioned that, you know, my plan right now, I'm on the stage of, if you know, we should make like a chart of, like, you know, like Ramsey's got his 7 baby steps to pay off debt. We should do like a chart of, like, for our situation, like investing or whatever, because I'm like, I have my pension set up, we paid off all our debt, I'm trying to fill up our TFSAs, both my wife and I, and mine's, you know, wherever we're at, and then once we fill that up, then we're going to be in a situation where we have to recalibrate everything and probably start paying into an RRSP would be the next step.
You can do both at the same time too. Like, it doesn't have to be one or the other, you know, like, spread your bets around, do it both. Like, that's what I'm doing. Sabrina and I are working together to fill her TFSA. I still have a little bit of room in mine. But I automatically, every 2 weeks, I contribute a little bit of money to my RRSP, and Sabrina does the same for her. So, like, we are actively filling both of our accounts at the same time.
And you're taking the money in your RRSP and you're investing in an ETF, am I understanding it?
Yeah, so that's just my way of diversifying my holdings. So I like to stock pick. I like to research. I like, you know, I love that stuff. It's like, that's what keeps me motivated. I'm excited to, like, look up companies and how they're doing. So my tax-free savings account, I'm like kind of building my own ETF. I basically look at like the biggest holdings of like high performing ETFs and I build that myself. And then I take out some of the companies that I think are stupid. But I understand that, like, there's a pretty good chance that I'm not going to do better than the ETF. So anyways, I do that because that keeps me motivated and engaged. But then in my RRSP, I don't screw around at all. I just invest straight into ETFs. I don't own any stocks in my RRSP. It's all ETFs.
Cool. Something that came up for us too. So my wife and I have been getting a pretty good tax return because our kids being in daycare, But there was a strategy that our accountant devised. Basically, the accountant, we do our taxes as early as we can. The accountant will get a pretty good idea of whether we're going to get a tax return or not. Mm-hmm. And she had suggested that if we needed to pay in or we weren't going to get as much, that we contribute before the deadline to the RRSP.
Yeah, absolutely.
To get a, you know, so
that's good advice.
That might be a strategy for, like, this year we didn't have anything to worry about. We got a big tax return in daycare. But next year, both our kids will be in school. They'll still be in after-school daycare, but the cost will be much less. So we should be not expecting as much of, if any, tax return next year or the year after. And in situations like that, then we might want to contribute, you know, some money at least into an RRSP to try and defer that a little
exactly.
bit. And then
I did that myself this year. So I had put a little bit of money into my RSP. So what I did was, like, we'll back it up a little bit. A while back, you've heard us ranting. If you follow us on socials, we love EQ Bank, right? EQ Bank pays really good interest on having your money in the account. I had my slush fund, my opportunity fund, we'll call it, fair amount of money sitting in the EQ Bank account. And over the year that I've been in EQ Bank, I made like something like, I forget what it was, $1,200 or something like that in interest. Now, interest is taxed at an incredibly high rate, and I didn't want to pay like half of my interest money to taxes. So what I did is I just looked at how much interest I accumulated in that account throughout the year. I took that amount and I threw it into an RRSP, which gives me a tax refund at tax time, right? So right before the deadline, I threw all that in. And then I actually sent all of my information, all my tax information, to the accountant before we actually went and met him. He plugged it in and said, okay, you're pretty much break even on your taxes. You won't really owe and you won't really pay. Like, if you do, it'll just be a couple of bucks either way. And I said, okay, that's cool. And he actually recommended, he's a conservative, wise man. I like him a lot. And he said, if I were you, I would, if you can, I'd throw in $1,500 or $2,000 into your RSP just to make sure that you don't pay anything. Cool, done. So that's what I did, just to make sure, because screw that. I don't want to pay anything. I'd rather get a refund. And that money, I have it. Like, I didn't take on debt to come up with this cash. And the way I see it, I'm investing that in myself. Like, what's the problem? Like, I'm happy to do it. And then that ensures that I'm going to get a refund, which I will then roll right back into the RSP, which is going to contribute to my refund next year, right?
Mm.
So.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward then with more retirement strategies. So we talked a little bit about making sure that you don't have a debt load, you know, paying off that mortgage, paying off the car, paying off the high debt stuff. Some of the people that I've talked to that have mentioned this, or even just in passing and me just, you know, eavesdropping or listening to people, a big expense for people moving forward, and this will apply to me having children, is post-secondary education for kids. And that is a huge strain on parents. And I don't like a lot of times what I hear, because my strategy, I think, is going to be much different than what I've heard, but I can't speak too much about that because obviously I'm not there yet, and things might look quite different actually being in that situation. However, there are things that you can do preemptively to either lower or completely get rid of the cost of, or not get rid of, but cover the cost of post-secondary education. And we did talk about that in our investing episode, the RESP, the Registered Education Savings Plan. So that is another investment tool that you can use to pay for your kids' post-secondary education. I won't go into all the details about that, but basically you want to contribute money into that for your children up until they're age 15. Please listen to that episode and look, do your research about that. But that will cover a portion of post-secondary education. Now, my strategy around the post-secondary education is, yes, we have this fund and we have a family plan, so we're gonna pay for, quote unquote, both of our children's school. But we are also planning to have our children work and pay for something. I haven't quite figured that out yet, but they're going to pay either their housing or their food or their car or something, depending on what the scenario is. Because the RESP isn't going to be enough to cover all of their schooling, depending on what they do. But nonetheless, it's going to be something that's going to allow us to have a good head start in education, to try our best to not have to go too overboard, but we'll see how it all plays out. But the point is that that's post-secondary education for kids. If you're going to be helping them out with that, which most parents do, that is another huge thing that can cause debt for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that can very much affect people's retirement. I've even heard of people dipping into their retirement savings to pay for some of those things.
Craziness.
And that being said, I would never suggest anyone dip into retirement savings to do anything other than if, like we were saying earlier, there's some sort of opportunity.
And you better be pretty certain that it's going to pay off. Like, there's got to be a decent path to success here. Like,
yeah.
This wild shot, like, I don't know. Some people have a better risk tolerance than me, but I would not be just betting it all on red, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not sure what our strategy around the RASP with the kids is going to be yet. We sort of talked about, like, maybe not even, like, being super transparent with them about, like I'm obviously not going to cause my children undue stress by saying, you got to pay for all your school. You know, I'm not going to, you know, put the boots to them. But we're probably just going to be, not secretive, but a little not as loose on the information, saying, like, you know, get working. We'll create a budget for them. They can save X amount of money for whatever it is, and then we'll sort of plan it out that way. But we do have this money, you know, that's going into this investment vessel, this account that's going to pay for the post-secondary education. So it puts you and us in a good position to, you know, not further reduce our debt load for planning for retirement, and that's sort of our strategy.
Well, I have thoughts. Like, I don't have kids, so I'm not probably the best person, but I do have opinions on kids and education and paying for it. So feel free to call me out and say, well, you don't get it because you're not a parent. But I'm going to go ahead and blurt it out, and you can tell me if it makes sense.
Sure. I think so, I know what you're going to say, but go ahead.
In the premium course that I have, I'm going to give you some free tidbits here. I talk about this at length, and I firmly believe in this. I don't think that paying the way for your kids to go to school is the best bet, okay? I think helping them along the way, absolutely. You want to give your kids the best shot, the leg up. But if you, think about this. As a kid, and I remember this quite well, being a high schooler, everyone's asking, what are you going to do when you grow up? What are you going to go to school for? And, you're 16, you don't know anything. You don't have any life experience. You don't even know what you like or what you don't like. And you're asked to decide, the future trajectory of your life based on nothing. But you have no experience. How could you know? So then naturally, you're going to just sort of pick, what sounds cool with no real knowledge of what that job or field is. And you're just going to take a wild shot at it. And usually you just model yourself off of parents or family, friends or whatever, not really knowing what that job is like. And you do this a lot of the times. You're young. You can't even problem solve that well because your brain's not developed enough. I know. I was there. I remember it very well. I chose firefighting as a career or as a school topic, I guess. And I didn't know the first thing about it. I just knew that you didn't have to sit at a desk all day. And that sounded really cool. So that's what I did. And my parents were like, cool, we'll pay for it. And I'm so grateful. What an opportunity. But that was a bet they had no business making. You know what I mean? 18-year-old Dan, I ran 5 times in my life. I'd been to the gym 3 times. Didn't really know how physical that was going to be. Wasn't really a high achiever in school. And then I'm going into this ultra competitive field where 5% of people get jobs. And going into it at 18 years old, no one who's 18 becomes a firefighter anymore. And back then either, that wasn't a thing. So that's a bad bet to make, you know? And I got super lucky. And in return, I guess sort of my parents did too. They paid for most of my school. I paid for a little bit, but I only had a few bucks. I was working part-time at a fast food joint. But my point is the risk on that bet was tremendous. Okay. Well, if I could go back in time, and what I do advise young kids, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids who ask me about a career in firefighting, I never tell them to pursue firefighting right out of school. It's a terrible bet. I tell them, go out there and get some experience. Do something else that makes sense financially. Go to trade school. They'll pay for your school to go get a trade, and they'll pay you to work in that field while you gain experience and learn. Go do that instead of accumulating this huge debt load. And then, who knows, you might fall in love with the trade and stick with it, and it's a great job. But if you still love firefighting after a couple of years of that, when you have, some tickets, some experience, some lived life, when you have that on your belt, then go pursue firefighting. That way you don't have to go 20-30 grand in the hole to pursue a wild shot that might not work out. You've got something to fall back on, right? And you hear this all the time, kids oh, I don't know what I want to do. It's cool. So don't rush into it. Go out there, go into the world at age, whatever, you graduate 17, 18, I guess, 18. It's go out in the world and start finding out what you don't want to do. Go work construction. You like that? Go look at the people in construction. Look at all the different jobs. You got your typical crews. I don't know. I'm not a construction guy, but look at road crews. Look at the heavy equipment operators. Look at the foremen. Look at all the people you're seeing. And think, does that seem like something I might be interested in? The world is a fascinating place. So start drawing inspiration and go down different roads. And if you hate it, sweet, quit and find something else. And you might find your passion. And then you'll have some education, some informed knowledge on what you should pursue. And I think that if parents just start shelling out cash on a thing that a 16-year-old said they want to do and they have no real knowledge of it, that's a bad bet. And also, when the parents pay for it, you might have a very mature, responsible kid. but you might not. And the kid will just blow it and they won't give a shit because it's not their money. Mm. My marks in fire college were like mid 70 was a pass. If you get below 70, you fail. I was getting like high 70s, like 77, 78 average in most of my classes. That was not a hard course. And then I went back to school for paramedics like a couple years later and I paid for that myself. My marks shot up to the point where I got on the dean's list. What was the difference? That's a much harder program. Two-thirds of my program failed. What was the difference? Did I get smarter? No, it was just my money on the line. I gave a shit now. I had a little lived experience. I knew how to study. I knew how to be responsible. And my money was on the line. It meant something now. Not that my parents' money didn't mean anything. I was just too young to really grasp it, you know?
There's actually studies out there, so there I can hear the parents now maybe listening to this episode or just in forethought thinking like, oh, well, you know, I need to pay my, I don't want any financial burden on my children because they need to focus on their studies. And to your point, they probably aren't focusing on their studies if you're paying for all their education. You know, you're young and dumb, you're partying, you're doing your thing. I mean, like, we've been there, we know what it's like. You guys, you know, have been there, you know what it's like, most people. And there's actually studies out there that show that kids that go to post-secondary education that have a job that are working actually do better grades-wise than the ones who don't, because they're the ones that are learning how to time manage better.
Yes.
They're the ones learning how to prioritize better.
It's maturity.
They're the ones that are like, well, you know, do I stay up and party all night because I got a test tomorrow or I got a shift I got to work tomorrow? Maybe not, you know, and then they can find that balance maybe a little bit better. Yeah. Maybe not. And maybe some of the ones that don't, well, then, you know, they suffer the consequences. Mm-hmm. And then some of them that do, well, they make it through.
Yeah. And there's this pressure. And I remember this, you know, being in high school, going into college, there's like this pressure that like, if I don't figure it out and go to college right away, I'm going to get left behind. Like all my friends will be ahead of me and they're going to have their careers and I'm going to be like some bum and not doing anything. And the funny thing is, like, I look back at a lot of the people I went to high school with, like a lot of them went to school and like realized it wasn't for them or didn't work out for whatever reason. And then they pivoted and they went back to school or pursued a different career. And it's like, now I'm in my 30s. And it's like some of these people have already gone through two careers or three careers. Like, it wasn't a race. It never was. It never fucking mattered. You know, like, don't worry about that. You're not getting left behind. It's a long life. So just find the thing that you want to do and just do it. Yeah. And if you start doing it and you decide it's not for you, cool. Shift gears. It doesn't matter, man. Yeah. Nobody cares. Just live your life.
Yeah, I remember having that. I what was proposed to me was staying in high school for an extra year. And at the time, I was like, no freaking way. And I really should have, because like at the time I didn't give two shits about school. And even in that mindset, I could have gone back to high school and fucking half-assed it if I really wanted to. I could have taken, like, you know, I don't know. I didn't have to do a full day. I could have taken half day school, you know, but in hindsight now, obviously it's, you know, can't change past, but I should have gone back to school and put some effort into it and brought my grades up a little bit. Cause then things might be, I mean, I can't complain. Things worked out really well for me, but I think I could have made it quite easier on myself to get where I'm at now or an equivalent if I would have given two shits. But anyway, it is what it is, and here we are. So,
and the crazy thing is, like, so, you know, hindsight's 2020. We're older, we're wiser, and like we have all these opinions. But like, I've thought about this a lot. I've talked about this with people. If I could go back in time and give myself advice on all of these things, and I've been very fortunate with career and stuff. I don't regret how my life has turned out, but I'm just saying, like, if I could go back and like tell myself all these lessons about saving money and investing and like whatever it is, like, I don't think I could have convinced myself.
No.
and I tell this to people all the time. It's like, there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. I can give, we're right now, we are giving you and anybody else and inadvertently your kids maybe, we are giving you the knowledge and you're probably listening to that knowledge that we're giving and you probably understand what we're saying, but to actually like apply that knowledge in real time, that's wisdom. Like understanding how that knowledge applies and when to use it and having the discipline to do it, that's wisdom. And I can't give you wisdom. I can give you knowledge, but you have to earn wisdom. And you earn wisdom through like hardship. And like, honestly, most wisdom is earned by fucking up. Mm. And then realizing, oh, that's why I should have done that. Yeah. And then you realize that knowledge, that's when the knowledge clicks into wisdom.
I guarantee you, if we had a time machine right now, I go back and talk to myself, trying to convince myself to go back to high school, I would have fucking given myself the finger. I was such a douche. And I know that's exactly what would have happened, because my mom tried so hard to convince me and I was just giving her the big old finger the entire time. And I would have done that to anyone. And yeah, it's just, yeah, so what you're saying totally resonates for sure. For sure. So moving forward then, and sort of, you know, getting back into that retirement mindset, what is a good strategy for living your best life in retirement and how to plan to get there? And that's where I want to use my strategy and what I'm trying to do, because I don't want to work till I'm 60, yeah. 65.
Let's hear it. What's your plan?
I want to retire at max 55. If I could go earlier, I would. Like, if I could retire today, I would. But I'd want to retire comfortably, okay? So I want to start sort of at the high level of where I see myself in retirement, what I'm doing, okay? I see myself with having my house paid off or very close to it. I see myself having a pretty sweet car, not a brand new one. I'm thinking like a 2019 Audi RS3 that I take care of, yeah, that I can rip around on.
This is going to be like 2040 or something, 2050.
Fine. So, you know,
you drive your 2019 Audi.
A 2030 Audi, okay? You know, I want to have a nice boat that I can float on. I don't want this big yacht. I just want a nice boat, okay? So basically, I want to be able to, you know, go to a breakfast joint a couple times a week and not have to worry about paying for the bill. I want to, like, you know, have a hobby, maybe something that makes me a little bit of income, maybe it doesn't, but it wouldn't matter because I'm good in terms of finances. But if I make a little extra quiche, why not? And that's kind of where I high level see myself. Things might shift. So what my plan is I have my pension, which I'm super lucky. I've been paying to that for a while, so I'm kind of set there. At least I have my like 10-15% of retirement income sort of set there. My investing strategy is to use my investments, and right now that's in my tax-free savings account, to pay in mostly dividend paying long-standing quality companies that have been paying a dividend for a long time, because I want to eventually build my dividend portfolio so large that my dividend payments in retirement will pay for my life.
And keep in mind, if you start early, which you are, and you, like you say, good, like long-term strong companies that have been there for paying dividends forever, but invest in the companies that grow those dividends as well. If you, so companies actually increase the amount of dividend they pay out year over year. And some of these companies have incredible streaks of like 50 years or mm-hmm. close to it. So if you get into one of these companies and you're in it for like 20, 25 years and they continue that track record, it's no guarantee that they will, but maybe they will. They have in the past, so they could in the future. Like, you're like 5% yield, let's say, today. So you're getting paid back 5% of your original investment every year. Like, in 25 years, that might be like a 25% per year return on the original investment. So that's something to consider.
Yeah, so my average yield right now with the companies that I'm invested in is roughly 5%. I've got some companies that pay 7, some companies that pay 2, but if you sort of took it right down the middle average, it's about 4-5% right now, and that's paid out per year. Well, they pay them out monthly and quarterly, but yield percentage is per year.
Yeah.
And yeah, so if we just think about it without getting into the details and you know, maybe confusing some people that may be new at this, if you can get companies that are paying you a dividend, you could be getting paid a paycheck from companies and holding investments with them, holding stock of their company. And in my situation, if I can get, you know, my pension and all my stuff set up and that's paying my bills, which will be, and my plan will be very little bills, mm-hmm. then my dividends that are paying are gravy, or vice versa. My dividends could be paying for my bills and my retirement, my pension will be my gravy, yeah. And that'll be my play money, which then I could go for a weekend away if I wanted to. I could go float on my boat and not give a shit. I could go to the breakfast joint and spend whatever money. I can take my kids out and we can go for a nice night and go to a hockey game or something, you know, and just do whatever, or get into a hobby, something that interests me, whether it makes me income or not, and not worry about it. And to me, like, that is so like exciting. Like, someone asked me, I've been asked a lot at work because I started a new job about a year ago and I like it. It's very challenging, but they're like, you know, do you like this job and you do this forever? And I'm like, well, yeah, I'd like to do something in this field for until I retire, but like I said, if I can retire tomorrow, I would.
Yep. No, I'm the same way, and like, it's, I have this like blessing and a curse thing going on where I find a lot of stuff really cool. Like, I got a lot of passions. There's a lot of things that I could spend my day reading and learning and experimenting with and just learning skills and doing stuff. And like, my job is very cool. I really like my job. There's a lot of really interesting things that I get into, but if I didn't have to do my job, I'd probably only continue to do it until it upset me one day and I'd just rage quit and then like move on to like raising cows or something, like, or like learning about like wind energy or something, like renewable energy. Like, there's so many cool things out there. I would rather not devote my entire life, like, you know, I probably got another 60 years in me or 50 years in me until I die. I don't want to devote all of that to what I'm doing right now. And if money was no object, like, I'd probably commit 10 years and then I'd move on to something else. And then I'd do that for a couple of years and I'd move on to something else. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of cool shit out there. It's a big world. It's kind of cool to experiment with stuff and broaden your horizons a bit.
For sure. You know, it's funny because my wife and I went out snowshoeing the other day and we were snowshoeing on a snowmobile trail. And you know, she's very much in the same mindset as me and we want to retire early. And she's all into this investing thing and doing the dividend thing. Exactly what I just said. She's probably going to listen to this episode and be like, hell yeah.
Was she Hulk Hogan? Hell yeah,
hell
brother.
Yeah. but she kind of did. Like, she responded to some of the social media posts saying, like, yeah, you know, like, fire, retire early. We're going to do it. And, you know, we were on the we're snowshoeing on the snowmobile trail and these snowmobiles are flying by. And she's like, you know, we should do that. And I'm like, we could. You know, if we continue on this trajectory and everything works out all right, like, yeah, we can buy a couple of machines. We can go weekends away and we can do stuff, you know, and, like, live our best life then. But yeah, so that'd be really cool. And that's my goal. Now, what I do want to drive home is, what if you're in, so we're, you know, 30, we're in our 30s and, you know, so, and we've been sort of doing this, you know, paying into a pension for quite some time. So we're in a pretty optimal situation overall. And what if you're somebody who is, you know, in that category we sort of began the episode with, that they're a little late to the game of the retirement fund, income, pension, all that kind of stuff. They may be bounced around jobs. They might be looking at retirement in the next 10 years. If they could retire earlier, they would, but they're sort of looking at it like, oh man, I got to work till I'm 65 and I don't really want to, but I kind of have to because I haven't been planning all that well. What if they're in that situation? What can you do? And we kind of touched on it a little bit, but I want to drive it home. And something you had mentioned in the article and in our discussions last week, sort of leading up to this episode, talked about doing what we're doing. You know, anyone can do this. You can open up, if you haven't been paying into your tax-free savings account, or if you've been doing something with it that may not be as optimal as perhaps paying into dividend paying companies, and you don't have to go out and look at these companies. And if you're not interested in doing any research at all, I don't recommend this strategy, but there are baskets of stocks out there which come in the form of an ETF that you can get into that will pay you these dividends.
Yeah. Most people should probably be doing some type of strategy like that. Like, that's what, honestly, like, the stats show, like, 90% of people don't beat that, just doing that. Like, even professional fund managers can't consistently beat that strategy. So probably that's what you should be doing, or some strategy like that.
And we're going to link the article. I keep referring to it, but it was a really good article. I read it this morning, and it really talks about this. And it's like, what if you are late to the game? What can you do? And even if you're late to the game, throwing some money into those investment type accounts, getting into some of these companies that pay these dividends or these ETFs, you could just, and hopefully if you're in the situation, and some, I'm thinking about somebody who I talked to recently, if your income is really good, there should be no, you shouldn't have any issue with putting more money into it to kind of play catch up, you know, and having, you know, repeating a lot of our themes, you know, having a good budget, having a plan, and maximizing your investment strategy, and retiring earlier than 65 can be a very realistic goal for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, just like off the top of my head, like bullet point form, like if you are in this situation, like things to consider. I won't tell you what's the most important, where to start, whatever. These are just things to look into. Pay off debt. Okay.
Boom.
Be debt free or minimal debt by retirement. Okay. That's something to consider. Invest in your TFSA to create income in retirement. Invest in your RRSP to create income into your retirement. If you do have a pension, remember, this might be something not everybody thinks about. You're going to have less deductions off of your pension payouts. You're no longer going to be paying into a pension when you retire. You're no longer going to be paying into CPP when you retire, right? Maybe your benefit deductions might not be there or may be reduced depending on what kind of situation you got going on. So you're going to keep more of your paycheck. So you might be looking at your pension calculator and be like, oh my God, I'm only going to be making $2,000 a month. But you're going to be keeping like 1600 of that, or I don't know, like it'll depend, but my point is you keep more of it, right? So that's like some good places to start. Other things to consider, do you really, like, your current standard of living, is that going to continuously be your standard of living? Do you really need the 4-bedroom house, or could you move maybe to a condo or a smaller house? Could you move out of the city? I don't know where this person lives, or hypothetically, if you're in a massive city like Toronto, maybe you move out to a small town somewhere where it's cheaper. Maybe you move out of country somewhere where it's cheaper. Like, there are, like, a guy I work with, his dad lives in Panama, And he lives like a king out there for like pennies on the dollar compared to here.
Yeah. I hear a lot of stories like that. People moved like to the East Coast, PEI, yeah, stuff
exactly.
like that.
Mm-hmm. Like stuff to consider. And it might not work for every person. There's a lot of considerations, but these are, you know, a couple of things to think about. Anything else you can think of?
On that subject, no, but moving forward to just wrap up this episode. So something that come up on our socials around this subject, someone had posted, and I was worried when he did, basically saying, you know, yeah, sure, retire early, great, living your best life in retirement, but a lot of people don't make it there. You know, health concerns, people die, things happen, absolutely. And the person mentioned, you know, living your best life now. And I worried when I first started reading that because I thought, uh-oh, here we go. Someone's going to be like, YOLO, FOMO, spend all the money now, take on a bunch of debt because we're all just going to die. And I thought it was quite morbid. But I read more into it and I didn't knee-jerk react. And they said that budgeting for them was key and they're living their best life, but within reason. So still getting into the activities that they want to, but being smart about it. Like in this person's case, they wanted to do a recreational activity. They bought secondhand equipment to do it. And I thought, thank you. I was a good way to wrap up that post because I was worried for a second.
Find balance.
Exactly. And that's another one of the themes that we kind of keep mentioning in almost every episode is finding that balance, right?
Well, we're going to Portugal this summer. Like, we're still doing all of these things and going to Europe in the summer and it fits into the plan. Like, you can have your cake and eat it too if you're smart about it.
Exactly. And I can't stress this enough. A budget. It's so... such a powerful tool. It's been a game changer, and I know I say that all the time for me, and it works for us, and yeah, like we're still going out to eat, we're still doing our things, we're still being able to afford stuff. It's so liberating. And unless you have something else to add, I want to kind of move to the last part of this episode.
Do it.
So we mentioned in the last episode, and I posted on the socials about the GIC ladder that we're going to be doing to buy our new car. And I adjusted our budget next month, and I looked at it originally, and I thought, oh man, like how are we going to be able to do this $400, $500 a month to do this GIC ladder? And I got a little bit of anxiety, and then I opened up my budgeting app, I looked at the next month of April, and I'm like, I moved some things around, you know, took a little bit off of the fun money, took a little bit off of the restaurant money, not a lot, say $100 a piece.
Took some off your kid's grocery bill.
Kidding. You know, we found savings where we could, because we don't need these things. They're just extras that we're doing. And now that we have something we're looking forward to, we could tweak it. And I found $400 and I put it in the budget. I posted it and it's there. $400 for the new car. That's going to be the one monthly payment. We're going to continuously do that, do our quarterly payment into a GIC to start that ladder. So that's where that budget is just key. And like, yeah, we're still doing the things that we want to do, cut back on a little bit, but hey, it's for the greater good. And that's all I wanted to say.
Cool. Well, we're a little over an hour now. Is that we want to wrap it up here?
Yeah, we're gonna wrap it up. So keep an eye on our socials, guys. Please like, subscribe, follow. We really appreciate all that. We're gonna link the article. It's a really good one, so take a peek at that. Keep an eye on the socials, like I said, about this GIC ladder thing. I'll post whenever we make our first payment into that the original account to keep the money, and then when we get the GIC ladder rolling, we will.
Yep. And for those who follow us on socials, if you have ideas for what you want to hear in a future episode, we'd love to hear about it, so please give us a shout. Topic that I've been thinking about sort of lately is doing an episode all about dividend investing. So just talking about a specific investing style.
Oh, I'd
love
that.
That'd be kind of cool. So if that's something you're interested in or you have other thoughts, let us know. And we often draw our ideas for these podcasts from conversations we're having with listeners like you guys. So give us a shout.
Today's episode.
Exactly. The last like three have been that. So yeah, we love to hear from you. And if you got a thought or something you want to hear about, give us a shout. All right. Thanks for coming out.
Cheers.